Seneca 13, the years AD 51 to 53, Leisure and Allies. Hi everyone, and welcome back to this podcast series on the life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca. In this episode, we'll take a look at the years AD 51 through AD 53. It was a period during which Seneca, having learned his lesson from previous encounters with the Julio-Claudian emperors, was still keeping a low profile. But around him, all sorts of currying of favour and jockeying for power were going on. These then were the formative years that would catalyse what came next. Forces were beginning to make their presence felt that would shape the imperial household for the next 15 years and, with it, the destiny of the entire Roman world. So let's start in AD 51. Our last cast saw the new empress making sure that nobody was in any doubt whatsoever that she, Agrippina, daughter of the great Germanicus, was now the most powerful woman in the Roman Empire. She'd been instrumental in recalling Seneca from exile back in late AD 48 or early AD 49, to become tutor to his son, a child for whom she held high ambitions. And as a bonus, Seneca had been elevated to the high political office of praetor, although the lack of any mention of his name in the annals around the late AD 40s to early 50s from the ancient commentators would indicate that Seneca had learned his earlier lessons well and was keeping a very low profile. He seems to have been content to perform his duty as tutor to Nero and dedicate what spare time he had to writing philosophically purist treatises like De Constantia Sapientis and De Tranquillitate Animi. He may even have made a start on his encyclopedic Naturales Quaestiones, or Natural Questions, a massive undertaking in the natural sciences in 7 books that he wouldn't complete for another 12 or 13 years, and that's something we'll cover in a much later podcast. I'd say it's also highly probable that Seneca wrote his De Ortio, or On Leisure, around this time, although the book has not survived intact and there's possibly at least half of it missing. It may have been dedicated to the same Serenus to whom Seneca dedicated De Constantia Sapientis and De Tranquillitate Animi, although that detail has never been definitively authenticated. But like those other two books, De Ortio is a work of philosophical purism, and I'll cover all three of them in the next podcast. But just for now, it will be enough to note that the Latin term ortium, which is often translated as leisure, is a tad misleading. To an upper-class Roman like Seneca, ortium was what you did when you weren't officially working, but it was what that time was used for that was important. To Seneca, ortium did not mean lounging around swilling wine or catching the afternoon gladiatorial slaughter, although he did attend those on occasion, but if only to voice his disapproval. No, Seneca's idea of otium was improving his mind, and that was something he achieved by reading, thinking, and then writing about philosophy, in particular, Stoic philosophy. Apart from some gratuitous bagging of the odious Caligula, there's virtually no contemporary outside reference in the three works I've just mentioned. So that means we have to look elsewhere for what was actually going on. Although Seneca himself may not tell us much about what he was up to during the years AD 51 to 53, other writers and commentators, both ones that actually lived through those years and ones writing a generation or two later, were more than happy to give us glimpses into the imperial household and its characters. So let's have a look at what they had to say. When Seneca first started to tutor his charge, he himself would have been somewhere in his early to mid-50s while Nero was still a boy of around about 12 years, And it was at that stage of a patrician Roman boy's education when he would traditionally have been sent to a rhetor to learn and refine the arts of oratory, declamation, and rhetoric. Now, Seneca would have fulfilled that role and more, because the whole point of Agrippina having appointed Seneca as her son's tutor was that the child be taught statecraft. Agrippina was Seneca's patroness. He was wholly indebted to her. So she would make absolutely sure that where it came to politics, Seneca would be teaching the boy exactly what Agrippina wanted him to teach. But what about Claudius? Did he get involved in Nero's education, or was he too busy conducting affairs of state? He must have had some say in the matter, because it is evident that by AD 51, Nero was widely recognised as the heir apparent. My own suspicion at this stage is that Claudius had enough confidence and trust in Agrippina that she was making sure Nero's education was fitting for an emperor to be. Her own pedigree, closely linked to the emperor's own, meant that she had been a short exile, excluded, around or exposed to the imperial family in some form or other since she was born. She fully understood what was expected of her. But what Claudius perhaps did not realise was that Agrippina was seeking to drive a wedge between her own son, Nero, and Britannicus, Claudius's natural son by Messalina. Nero was the elder of the two by a couple of years, and it is apparent that right from his adoption, it was Nero and not his younger stepbrother who was being groomed to succeed Claudius. Nevertheless, Britannicus, while he was still around, was competition, and Agrippina was having none of that. The Empress made absolutely sure that the people of Rome were aware whose togaed backside would be the next to sit on the royal throne. In AD 51, Nero, now 13 years old, publicly donned the toga virilis, or the manly toga, thereby officially signalling that he was now ready to take on some public duties. He was named the Princeps Juvenum, or the Princeps Juventutis, the Prince of Youth, just as the young Augustus had been a few generations previously. He was also given consul designate status, the powers of which office he was entitled to exercise outside the city proper. But during all of this very public raising of Nero's status, poor little Britannicus was left standing there with no honours whatsoever. While Nero was allowed to wear triumphal robes to the games in the circus, Britannicus had to dress as a minor. So it must have been patently obvious to the huge crowds which way the political wind was blowing. To make matters worse for Britannicus, Agrippina chopped any potential support for the young imperial leftover off at the knees. Any praetorian officers, that's praetorian guard officers, who demonstrated the least sympathy towards Britannicus were removed from their posts, as were any slaves who had remained loyal to the boy. But even that wasn't enough for Agrippina. She complained to Claudius that Britannicus had treasonously addressed Nero as Domitius, which was his pre-adoptive name, and that forced Claudius to exile or execute all the boy's former tutors, and they were tutors whom Agrippina made certain she replaced with her own nominees. Having removed any potential support for Nero's competition, Agrippina set out to further enlarge the group of those close to the imperial court who were loyal to her alone. She already had Seneca ensconced as a praetor and as tutor to Nero. Now she needed to secure the loyalty of the only armed unit legally allowed to operate within the city walls, the Praetorian Guard. The incumbent commanders, Lucius Scaeta and Rufius Crispina, whom Agrippina considered still sympathetic to the late Messalina and her offspring, simply had to go. She manipulated Claudius by claiming that a rivalry existed between the two commanders, even though historically there is no evidence of one. Having two men in charge, she said, was a volatile and potentially dangerous situation. Claudius, as a consequence, got rid of both men, and Agrippina had them replaced by a single commander of her own choosing, Sextus Afranius Burrus. Now, Burrus was a distinguished soldier, but like Seneca, he was one of Agrippina's creatures, a man indebted to the Empress as his patroness. Now, in time, Burrus and Seneca would ultimately work well together as a team, but that is a story for a later podcast. Agrippina also worked on the wider population. She understood that it was all about theatre, all about putting on a good public show. To demonstrate unequivocally that she was now top bitch in Rome, she made sure she was seen entering the Capitoline, the political and religious heart of the city, in a ceremonial carriage originally commissioned and ridden by her predecessor Messalina. And Agrippina also began to clear out any senators she felt were no longer of any use to her, even if, like old Lucius Vitellius, they had originally been instrumental in getting her where she now was. The wider record for AD 51 tells us that there was considerable unrest in the regions around Armenia and Parthia, and that dominated foreign policy and probably took up most of Claudius's time. Back in Rome, a famine caused by a corn shortage was experienced, and the city also suffered a succession of earthquakes. Apart from all of this, and despite one reported incident of crowd heckling, Claudius rode out that year with his principate intact. Agrippina herself appears to have been still widely respected, and Seneca continued to keep his head down. In AD 52, Agrippina sought to enlarge her own faction within the imperial household. Seneca and Burrus were firmly in her debt, and she had already won over Claudius's influential freedman treasurer Pallas. She now tried it on with Narcissus, another of Claudius's close circle of freedmen, but he proved a harder nut to crack. Probably attempting to demonstrate what benefits joining her gang could reap, Agrippina secured Pallas an honorary praetorship, a reward for proposing a law that Roman women who married slaves could be financially penalised. And that was something for which Pallas also collected a cool 15 million sesterces. And that sum brought his personal fortune up to a reported 300 million sesterces. I think it's worthwhile at this point to digress for a minute or two and look at the massive opulence that was almost carelessly tossed around at this top level of Roman society. My favourite source for this type of stuff is the elder Pliny. Unlike Tacitus, Suetonius and Dio Cassius, all of whom wrote well after the events of this period, and all of whom had some kind of personal axe to grind, the elder Pliny, who was born in AD 23, actually lived through the times in question. Sure, he was a military and naval commander, he'd eventually die during the famous eruption of Vesuvius in AD 79, and he was sensible enough to stay well away from Rome during the reigns of the more unstable emperors. But his massive work, the Naturalis Historia, or Natural History, which he must have been compiling throughout his entire life, is chock-a-block full with weird and wonderful facts and cracking little anecdotal snippets that give us an insight into life among the Roman rich and privileged. Included among these are little glimpses into the imperial household itself. Among other fantastic bits of trivia, the elder Pliny cites the now-lost memoirs of Agrippina herself, in which she claimed that her son Nero was actually born feet first. Pliny also reports that Agrippina herself had two canines on the right side of her upper jaw, and that was a physical feature that was regarded in ancient Rome as a sign of fortune's extreme favour. Once she became empress, says Pliny, Claudius purchased for his new consort a white nightingale for the staggering sum of 600,000 sesterces. And Agrippina also possessed a thrush that could mimic what people said. And Pliny says that at that time, that was a marvel that was totally unheard of. Talking birds seem to be all the rage up at the royal palace, because Pliny also tells us about a starling and some nightingales that were owned by the royal princes, Nero and Britannicus. And these birds were trained to speak both Latin and Greek phrases. And the birds were, they were trained diligently and often enough that the phrases over time grew longer and longer. And that must have been pretty incredible. And then there were the security measures in the imperial household. Claudius issued those who were to have free access to him with golden rings containing his likeness. And the emperor is also credited with being the first to use a signet ring with no gems set in it to imprint a wax seal. And that apparently started a fashion in the upper echelons of society. The imperial family, you see, were the celebrities of their time. Another rage that Claudius started was wearing a smaragdus, that's a kind of emerald, or else an onyx stone. And his doing that was something that drove the market price of those gems sky high. So in reality, it's not so very different from celebrities and fads today. The elder Pliny is full of fascinating information. Among my favourites for this time period are these. The tallest person during the reign of Claudius was somebody called Gabarra, who stood at a colossal 9 feet 9 inches. Something else is that there was a woman called Statilia who lived to a venerable 99 years of age. And how about this one? An Italian boa, that's a snake, was found and killed on the Vatican Hill, which at that time was just across the Tiber from the city proper, with a whole child inside it. Pliny also recounts the bizarre report that a battle took place between Claudius and a killer whale in the harbour at Ostia, that's Rome's port, during some construction work. As regards more practical matters, the art of painting on lapis was perfected over this era. And Pliny also says that Claudius himself is credited with improving the quality of paper by adding the woof, that's the cross layer, to the parchment weave to prevent smudging and stylus puncture. And I can't resist just one more, even though it's about the late Messalina, because it unequivocally demonstrates the depravity and lust of that passionate and to me absolutely fascinating woman. Pliny writes that Messalina, while empress, took on a prostitute in a copulation contest and beat her with a score of 25. That's 25. For the people, Claudius and Agrippina staged spectacles on a massive and lavish scale. The mock battles on the remains of the Fucine Lake, for instance, which Claudius had attempted to drain because of its malaria threat, attracted huge crowds. Claudius appeared there in a splendid military cloak, with Agrippina by his side looking every bit the empress, as she stood dressed from head to foot in incredibly expensive gold cloth. 19,000 criminal combatants took part in the first naval battle spectacular, and they were surrounded by rafts to prevent them from attempting to escape. The second attempt to drain the lake involved gladiatorial battles on pontoons, but an engineering cock-up resulted in many combatants and spectators being swept away by cascading water. There's an interesting footnote to this episode, and it's a sign that all was not right between Agrippina and Claudius's freedman Narcissus, because she blamed him as chief engineer for the debacle at the lake, while he responded by accusing her of being a dictatorial female who suffered an extreme of feminine ambition. And so we move on to AD 53. The main event of this year, for our purposes, is that Seneca's charge, the young Nero, who'd now reached 16, finally married Claudius's natural daughter Octavia, to whom he'd been betrothed for a few years already. Seneca's teaching was obviously paying off, as the young man demonstrated eloquence in public speaking and diplomacy during public ceremonies and official appearances. His mother Agrippina, meanwhile, continued her bulldozing run to consolidate her status and demonstrate her growing power. Like Messalina had done with another senator before her, Agrippina coveted the gardens of a high-ranking patrician. This time it was Titus Statilius Taurus. To get him out of the way, Agrippina accused him of extortion when he'd been governor of Africa, and she also added a couple of charges of practicing magic to boot. Now, Agrippina got the senator's former deputy, Tarquitius Priscus, to finger his old boss, with the result that Taurus eventually took his own life. Now, I mention this incident for one reason, which is that here, in AD 53, we begin to see the first signs that Agrippina was not having it all her own way. And that's because the man she used to finger poor old Priscus, his deputy, was a man whom the Senate loathed so much that, as a result of the proceedings, he was exiled, and that was despite being under Agrippina's protection. Okay, as I mentioned earlier, the next podcast will look briefly at the three works I believe Seneca composed around this period. That's De Constantia Sapientis, the Constancy of the Wise Man, De Tranquillitate Animi, on the Tranquility of the Mind, and De Ortio, on Leisure. But we'll finish off today's podcast with a little sneak peek into the future. It is reported by the ancient commentator Suetonius that on the very first night that Seneca heard he had been appointed as Nero's tutor, he had a dream. He dreamed that his charge was not, in fact, Nero, but was actually the evil, cruel, and infamous Caligula. So what was that all about? A piece of old tosh written by a rather sensationalist later writer? Or a genuine prophetic dream on Seneca's part? Only time would tell. I hope to see you all in the next podcast.